Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we were talking about the Niagara Escarpment to start the program today. We're going to move quite a bit west and talk about the Driftless area of our state. It's an environmental wonder as well, and we're learning about the history of the area, thriving trout streams, sand prairies, and a whole lot more as we visit with our guest, Reggie McLeod, back with us once again today. He is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. It's a great magazine. I always enjoy reading my copy. It brings us news from life along the Mississippi River. Today we're going to be talking about, oh, how small river towns can shrink smart and what we can learn about native restoration from a natural sand prairie. And we'll check in with the Mississippi River tour boat industry. All that's part of the latest edition of Big River Magazine. Maybe you live along the Mississippi River or in the Driftless area. What do you enjoy about it? I hope you'll join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And Reggie McLeod, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be back.
Well, let's kick things off. I like to fish, and one of the articles in the magazine this time was an uncertain future for driftless trout. Tell us about that 50-year rehabilitation of trout streams in the Driftless area.
Well, it's really interesting because the Driftless area is blessed with a lot of really great trout streams. But there was a time early in the 20th century when a lot of the land was pretty degraded, and it was because we were, you know, people were learning how to farm it, and techniques were changing, and we didn't understand a lot about hydrology that we do today. And so there were huge gullies sometimes that could, you know, bigger than a house. And there was a lot of flooding, mudslides, all this sort of thing. And the first research on soil conservation in the United States, the most important research, actually started in Coon Valley, Wisconsin, kind of in the middle of the Driftless area, because that was some of the more challenging geography to conserve soil in because of the steep bluffs and so on. So there was a lot of work done there, and they learned a lot about contour plowing and planting crops in contour strips and, you know, taking better care of creeks and how to repair gullies and retaining water on the land so it doesn't run off so quickly and so on. And then that was kind of a base for teaching farmers about it in the 30s, and even today a lot of the work that the federal agencies do with farmers is based on things they learned back in the 30s in Coon Valley. So it's made a lot of improvements in the Driftless area, and a lot of trout streams that were basically dead, you know, that were just muddy ditches basically, are just terrific trout streams now. And I feel a little uncomfortable talking about this on the radio, because I'm tempted to keep it secret. The trout fishing has become so good. I stopped fishing for about 10 years because I was kind of afraid of ticks and you know, getting some tick-borne disease. In the last few years, I've gone back to trout fishing and being careful and all that. But I'm amazed not only at how many trout there are, but how few trout anglers there are out on the streams now. And that's what the article deals with a little bit, is not only do we have great conditions on the streams now, but we have fewer anglers.
Yeah, that's amazing. And yet, even though we've got these improvements, there are some threats to the health of the trout streams.
Well, the big threat, and I was at a Driftless Area Symposium, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, and there was a presentation there by a colleague of the author that wrote our story, actually. And it showed the map that we have in the magazine that showed the quality trout streams in the driftless area now, or actually in all of Wisconsin, and then how they'll look in, I think it was 50 years, if climate change continues the way that it's been progressing. And I was shocked. I mean, it's pretty depressing. Oh, yeah. And that's just because the temperature goes up a couple degrees in those streams and in the water, and it has a huge effect on the ecosystem of the streams.
Yeah, it does indeed, and it was scary looking at those maps.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my goodness me! Well, that's one of the stories, and of course, in Big River Magazine, and maybe I should have asked you this right off the bat. For those who aren't familiar with it, you cover a pretty broad range of topics typically that relate to the river.
Yeah, we cover the river from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities, and really the driftless area really begins just downriver of the Twin Cities and just upriver of the Quad Cities. And because the tributaries are so important, like the St. Croix River, the Wisconsin River, and so on, we really extend our coverage to the whole driftless area, because it's all part, just as your previous guests were talking about, it's all part of a unique ecosystem. The driftless area has geography and ecosystems and plants and some animals that you really don't find in the surrounding area. So it's
very cool.
Yeah, it's a great place. I love it.
Yeah. Ryan in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've lived in the La Crosse area for 14 years, and I just want to comment. You're totally right about the trout fishing. It's beautiful here. The conservation efforts are great. The trails are awesome. And being able to hop on the river with my kayak and do a nice quick run is awesome. And the people are really great over here, so stop on by.
All right. Great. Comment on that? Yeah, you want to comment on it?
Well, the cat's out of the bag. What can I say? If everyone if everyone moves here, it'll probably change. But no, I'm not worried about that. There's plenty of trout. I agree with him. I often have a lot of people just drive around with their kayaks or canoes on the car, and if after work I can drive a few blocks and throw my solo canoe in the river and paddle around an island or just drift around and stuff. It's like living in a place that I used to go to go on vacation.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah.
Well, he did mention the communities and the nice communities, and you do have a nice article in the magazine this time around. I think it was titled Quiet or Too Quiet. Checks in with how small Mississippi River towns are managing economically and socially during this time. How are folks doing?
Well, I worry in general, because a lot of small towns have been getting smaller in the driftless area because of flooding. Like Gay's Mills is an example of that. They've really gotten knocked around the last few years with the increased rainfall and precipitation. And then also there has been a tendency to concentrate in big cities, which is good for the environment in a way, you know, to get people close together so they don't have to drive as much. But it's taken a lot of jobs away from the smaller towns. And one town in the story, Cassville, the two main employers in town were two different power plants owned by two different companies, coal-fired plants, and they both closed within about a year and laid everybody off. And that was a big blow to that town. And it's on a stretch of the river. Usually the bridges are about 25 to 30 miles apart on the river. Well, Cassville is right in the middle of about a 55-mile stretch with no bridge. So they've been dependent on a ferry to get across the river there. And the ferry couldn't run the last few summers most of the time because of flooding. And it's a gorgeous town. There's a beautiful state park with walk-in campsites, and there's a Stonefield, a historic farming village, and it's a gorgeous place. And there aren't jobs, so how are people going to survive? On the other hand, with the virus, a lot of offices have closed and they've sent people to work at home, and they're not going to open those offices again. A lot of places they're finding it's just or even more efficient in some cases to have people work at home. And how long is it going to take for those people to say, well, gee, I could sell my house in this major city in Madison or Minneapolis or whatever and buy a house twice the size for less money in Cassville or Lansing, Iowa or somewhere and work just as easily from there. And like the caller said, I could just, after work, I could just paddle around out in the backwaters or something and fish for a while, you know. So
yeah.
There's some hope that that might be one good thing that comes out of the virus, but we'll see, you know.
Well, it's still a we'll see kind of thing yet.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Bob in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yeah. There are a lot of amazing things in the Driftless, but one thing that's amazed me are the pine remnants, and I'm wondering if your guests could speak to their origin, where they're located, the plant communities, animal communities that exist in what I think are pre-glacial ecosystems.
Oh,
did he say pine?
Right? Yes. Yeah.
Oh, like pine trees.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. There aren't that many, and a lot of them that I'm aware of were planted in the 30s. I mean, a lot of pine trees were planted in the 30s for soil conservation because where you had big open fields and there was a dry period there when they had dust storms. They had dust storms here. There were dust storms that where the dust built up as high as the top of fence posts, you know, right here in the Driftless area. And so part of the soil conservation movement had farmers planting trees along their fence lines to kind of keep the wind down on that blows across the fields. So a lot of pines were planted on state land as plantations and then neglected. They weren't really pruned and harvested according to plan. I'm not going to point my fingers anywhere, but sometimes when I'm out hiking, I find these dense. And the key is, if you look and they're planted in rows, well, that's not, if they're the same age and they're planted in rows, that's not natural. So I don't see too many otherwise, though, around here. I'd be interested in knowing specifically some places, and that might spur my memory. Tell us that.
Well, Bob may have some more information on that. Our guest, Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. He'll be with us till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we will be back with Reggie McLeod. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about the environmental and economic future of the Mississippi River communities. Reggie McLeod, our guest, he is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. So what do you think makes the Driftless area so special? How do you spend time on the Mississippi River? How's the economy of your small river town doing? I hope you'll join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Reggie, you know, we had Bob, caller Bob, ask about the origin of pine in the Driftless area. And we got a call during the news from Jeanette in Lawrence, Illinois. And so let's go to Jeanette and see what she's got to say about it. Jeanette, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was born in Guttenberg, Iowa, and raised on my family's dairy farm near there. And just a little ways south of there in Dubuque County is White Pine Hollow State Preserve. And it is preserved for native pines, although they have very poor recruitment because there hasn't been fire and the maples and things have been taking over. But speaking with some state ecologists with Iowa some years ago, that cohort dates back to the remnants and the youngsters from the early European settlement, the 1840s and 50s. And the older trees now are what had sprouted from that. And so, yes, there are some native white pines in our area. And further in northeast Iowa, there are even some other conifers that are native up by Bluffton. But I also wanted to thank him so much because growing up in northeast Iowa and now living in extreme northwest Illinois, right on the state line here in Warren, we feel a dearth, a great dearth of news for those of us who consider ourselves more regionalist than state residents. When I lived in northeast Iowa, we'd go to Madison more than Des Moines because it was closer. And here, Madison and things in Minnesota and Iowa are far closer than Springfield. I've never been to Springfield in the 11 years I've lived over here. So, and it's something I wish there was a radio station that would give some more things to those of us that are driftless. Because I don't consider myself an Illinoisan. I consider myself a driftless resident. Even though I lived and worked away in the Park Service doing biology for 15 years, I purposely came back to the driftless. And it's slightly underserved sometimes with, it gets caught up because if you're a resident of one state or the other, you're too far from the capitals to usually speak up about some of the issues, or they've never even heard of where you are.
Yeah. Well, do you have you read Big River Magazine, Jeanette?
I have, and I need to renew my prescription, my subscription because it is out of date, so I'll have to get some more again.
Oh, okay. Good. That's I like good to hear that. Yeah.
Well, Reggie, a comment?
Yeah, several. First of all, regarding the pines, during the break, I was really racking my brain to think about that. And there are, if you go up the Cedar River, which is in the driftless area, the lower part of it, there's a lot of pine trees along the Cedar River corridor. And when you get over into Jackson County and around Black River Falls, that's the predominant tree. And I believe those are all native. There are also tamaracks right around, the middle of the driftless area. They grow in swamps and along creeks and so on. There's a tamarack creek and a little tamarack creek just south of Arcadia, Wisconsin. And those are pine trees that lose their needles in the winter, just like the hardwood trees do. The needles fall off and then they grow back in the spring. And then also we have a lot of cedar trees, which aren't pine trees. There's certainly a lot of cedars and they're native, and people who are restoring prairies, especially on the goat prairies, on the bluffs, on the high bluffs, are often fighting with cedar trees. And they're a growing problem because there are no fires anymore. The fires, they're very susceptible to fire. And that's why the goat prairies were there, was because they survived the fires and the cedar trees didn't. But now a lot of those same bluffs are just dense with cedar trees, and there's no understory around the cedar trees either. And they blocked a lot of nice overlooks, too, actually. So that's kind of expanding. And I said, well, there weren't any pine trees that I knew of, but there are some native ones around here, and those are the ones I'm familiar with. I'm going to visit this White Pine Hollow. I've never been there, and it sounds interesting.
Yeah, it does. Jeanette, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wade in Madison. We'll give you a chance now. Hi, Wade.
Oh, hi. I grew up on the river. I'm a self-described river rat, and I boat a lot of stretch from Cassville up to Trumplo. But growing up, we had tons of sandbars, just beautiful stretches. And now we see these giant dredge piles. And, I don't understand the debate between, making sandbars to help contain the river as well. And I understand that there may be some native species concern there, but I'd like to know more about the debate on that. And couldn't there be a compromise now?
Well, we could do a whole series of shows on that, but that's what I'm trying to think of. Because the sand is a problem because they're trying to maintain a 9-foot channel in the Mississippi River, and that's why all the locks and dams were built, and that's why the sand has to be dredged and piled up, and the regulations don't let them keep the sand in the river, in the floodplain. They have to move it out of the floodplain before long. You know, they can't keep it there for very long. And so a lot of the beaches are artificial, are places where they stored sand. A lot of the beaches also were created by the wing dams that were built in the late 1800s to focus the flow of the river into the main channel. By focusing the flow, they allowed a lot of sand to fall out and sediment to fall out behind the wing dams and create beaches there. And then a lot of the beaches were originally created by dredge material, and they've just remained. You know, they haven't washed away. Other ones have disappeared because of erosion. Now, with the climate change last year, there was more water that went past Guttenberg. The volume of water that went past Guttenberg, Iowa, for the whole of 2019 was 30% more than the highest record flow on record.
Whoa.
So it was 30% over. You don't have that happen with hydrology or weather where something is 30% more than something else. So the Army Corps of Engineers has been overwhelmed trying to keep up with the dredging, and that has meant more sand, and that has meant sandbars in places where there weren't sandbars before, and the backwaters are filling in, and Lake Bethune is filling in. So it's creating dramatic, the combination of that and other problems are causing dramatic changes on the river, and the Corps' main job on the river is to keep that 9-foot channel open, and they're really scrambling to do that. This year they're catching up a little bit. I mean, they've had a break, but the 4 years before that were pretty rough for everybody, recreational boaters as well. They're making up for lost time this year, I think.
Yeah. And thanks for that, Wade. Appreciate it. A couple of things from his call. Well, you mentioned the filling in, and Lake Pepin, as a matter of fact, is. You have a story on Lake Pepin and the fact that it was kind of disappearing.
Yeah. It would fill in naturally over the course of, you know, hundreds of years. But it's filling in rather quickly now from the upper edge. And I just had a long conversation with a friend yesterday who is a river pilot for many years. And we were talking about this. When you look at the river and you look at the backwaters, you can't tell that they're filling in. You can't tell if you're looking at water that's 20 feet deep or a foot and a half deep. And so it's hard to tell people who aren't familiar, who haven't been fishing and boating on the river a lot, how quickly it's filling in, not just Lake Pepin, but all the backwaters. But there are a lot of places that were 20 feet deep a few decades ago that you can't get a boat through now. And it's accelerated because of the global warming, and the locks and dams have really made the problem worse too. So it's and it's very complicated. I mean, there's a lot of things that come into play, including, you know, agricultural practices too. But climate change is the elephant in the room.
Yeah. But there are people that are working on Lake Pepin and trying to turn it around.
Yes, the Army Corps and the DNR have put together a project that's underway, really. They're going to the little village of Bay City on the upper end. It's in the Wisconsin side on the upper end of the lake, has kind of lost access to the lake. It's silted in so much on that part of the lake. And they're going to build some islands with material that they dredge. They're going to restore some of the channels and some of the deep spots in the backwaters that have disappeared and open access to Bay City and try to design it. Their island building skills have really improved over the years. They've learned so much about how to build these islands. They can actually build them so that they'll kind of grow on their own over time. you know, they can really anticipate now what's going to happen to a channel they dredge or an island they build. They can kind of anticipate what's going to happen to that over the next 20 or 30 years. So it's going to be a lot nicer when they finish the project. And it's still in the planning stages, but I think pretty soon they're going to start actually getting out there and doing some of the work. And it should help the whole lake, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Richard in Two Rivers, let's give you a chance. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on the air. I have two separate questions. The first one, and I wanted to ask your guest speaker if he's familiar with where the main branch of the Root River comes in from Minnesota into the Mississippi. I used to push my boat over the sandbars and then go up in the river, and it's just teeming with different types and varieties of fish. And the other question I have is I live on Lake Michigan, and there's hardly any beaches left. The water's taken over. And how much of an effect does the water flow through Lake Michigan into the Mississippi is controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers?
Well, I'd like to. The Army Corps of Engineers gets a lot of blame, some fair and some not fair. But the Great Lakes and the Mississippi are two entirely different watersheds, so they're really not connected. So it either goes into one or the other, and the Corps doesn't have any influence on that. And I lived not far from the Root River, and I lived in Brownsville for 5 years too. And yeah, I'm very familiar with it, and that has changed tremendously in the decades since I moved here. There used to be a lot of farms at the lower end of the river there, right where it flows in by Lawrence Lake, and that's all been sold to the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Minnesota DNR because it was flooding so frequently that they couldn't even graze cows on it, let alone plant crops on it. And that's kind of worked its way up the river. The hydrology has changed a lot for a lot of different reasons. And some of it is agriculture. I mean, I paddled down that river and seen where farmers have plowed right up to the edge of the river. I mean, actually, corn is growing right on the edge of an eroding bank in the river. And that has improved in the last 4 years. There are laws that require buffer zones now between cropland and waterways, and that's going to make a big difference over time. But a lot of the damage is already done on that river. It's still a beautiful river, and it's a great river to paddle. But that whole delta of it has changed so much in the decades. You go farther up, and it's a legendary trout stream farther up there. It's really interesting. I there's a wonderful bike trail along it too. And a lot of neat stuff when you get up around Houston and Rushford and Lanesboro and those places. It's really cool. Yeah.
Richard, thank you so much for calling. I want to go back to Cassville for just a minute. You mentioned earlier that they got a long way to go to get a bridge, to reach a bridge to get across. I would imagine a bridge would really help the economy of Cassville and some of the other small river towns.
Sure. You know, Guttenberg is right across there, and the ferry gets people back and forth. But, you know, it gets a little expensive if you have to take a ferry every day. And if you've ever driven to Cassville from Prairie du Chien or from Madison or something, you realize it's kind of off the beaten track. And you know, that's something I'd like. I mean, personally, if I'm on vacation, I want to find a place that's off the beaten track. That's kind of what I look for. If you have to live in a place like that, it's difficult. And a bridge would help it tremendously. You know, if people worked in the Dubuque area, they could get there much more easily. Guttenberg is a bigger town, and there are a number of businesses, you know, north of Dubuque and west of Guttenberg and that. It would just give people a lot more options. And in terms of medical care, too, that's another thing that hurts a lot of these small towns. They used to all have hospitals. Well, almost all of them had hospitals. And a lot of those hospitals have closed, and they've kind of centralized medicine in the Driftless area out here, where everyone has to go to La Crosse, or they have to go to Rochester, they have to go to Madison when they want any kind of complicated medical care. And that's why a lot of people move to those areas. That's one of the things that people look at. And a bridge would put Dubuque a lot closer to folks in Cassville, too, you know, or just make it a little more livable if they had that connection.
Yeah. I did want to mention one other another article in the magazine, and it's about the Holland Sand Prairie State Natural Area near Holman, Wisconsin. And, you know, looking at the photos, I thought, what a beautiful place. Talk a bit about that, Holland Sand Prairie State Natural Area.
This is a great place. It's a great time of the year to visit the prairies because there's a lot of things in bloom. And people recreate prairies, but just like virgin forests, there are very few virgin prairies left in the upper Midwest. And the complexity of the plants and animals that live in these places is almost overwhelming because, as the story talks about, you know, there are species of insects that are dependent on one specific species of plant to build its nest, or one specific flower, you know, for pollen, or like everyone knows about monarchs, that they need to lay their eggs on milkweed, so they can't reproduce without milkweed. But there are hundreds or maybe thousands of relationships like that between plants and animals, and in a natural environment like this. So when people restore prairies, they restore the big plants that you see, but there are many little tiny plants and plants that grow and bloom only briefly throughout the year. And a prairie like this still has a lot of that intact. A lot of those plants and animals are still there. That's why it's beautiful. I mean, it's just beautiful.
Oh,
even if you don't know anything about it, you'll enjoy it. But if you really spend a little time and you watch, there's really a lot going on there, a lot more than's going on in a park or your lawn or you know, any other place you're likely to go. And yeah, that's what the article's about.
It is really a gorgeous, gorgeous place. Well, one of the things I like, you have many short stories in your little short articles in your magazine always, too. And I have everything from a loon taking down an eagle.
Yeah, a lot of people like that one. Yeah, that's good.
A loon actually stabbed an eagle in the heart and killed it as it was trying to get away with the loon's little one. And another one, is it Betches Mustard? How does that pronounce? Betches Mustard?
Oh, you know, I'm not from the Quad Cities, and we're both probably going to mispronounce it. At least, you know, we get Guttenberg right and stuff. But Bochy's, I think it
Bochy's,
is.
Bochy's Mustard.
See, now you're going to get calls from the Quad Cities, but yeah.
Yeah. Won a gold medal in the worldwide mustard competition. So, and they're from, Bochy's is, you know, from that area. So,
yeah, from Rock Island. Well, we cover everything from farming to fishing to mustard, Larry. If it's from the Driftless area, it could end up in Big River. And loons, even though the loon didn't kill the eagle in the Driftless area, the eagle was dissected in Madison, and that's close enough for a good story.
Oh, man, always fun, Reggie. And people can subscribe or get information at, you go to Big River Magazine.com, right?
Yes, or call 1-800-303-8201. And right now, if you call that number, you go to our Facebook page, we're giving away free copies of the May-June issue. We have some extras of those, and we decided the first 30 or 40 people to ask us, they'll get a free copy of that. So give us
what's
a call.
What's that 800 number again?
1-800-303-8201.
1-800-303-8201. You can get a free copy. Reggie, thanks. Yep. Always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Me too.
Reggie McLeod, editor of Big River Magazine, and he's publisher of it as well. Great to have him with us. He'll come back and we'll talk with him again. Tomorrow we'll talk with Kelly Jo Ford about our new novel, Crooked Hallelujah, which tells the story of two Cherokee women managing life's challenges during the 80s. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mehler.